This is Richard Verona. I'm conducting an oral history interview with General Dennis B. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan is in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I am in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library interview room. Today is January 30th, 2003. It's approximately 10 after 10 Central Standard Time. And, sir, we'd like to start this. If you could just give us a little bit of background about yourself, when and where you were born, and a little bit about your childhood.
Okay. I was born in 1927 in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. I went to Catholic elementary school and high school in that town. My mother kind of started me a little bit early, I guess, and I graduated from high school in 1944 during World War II.
Okay.
I was 16 years old then. In 1945, I enlisted in the Navy. I was a seaman first class. Mm-hmm. I was probably the last male in our high school class that went into the service at that time. World War II ended while I was, still in training with the Navy. But about that time period, I had an opportunity to take a competitive exam to try to get an appointment to one of the service academies.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had arranged that. So I took a civil service exam and eventually ended up with an appointment to the United States Naval Academy.
Okay.
I went there in 1946, graduated in 50. During that time, they'd established the DOD and made the Air Force a separate service.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in flying, and it appeared that this was before the Korean War. If I would have stayed in the Navy, it would have been 3, 4, 5 years to get into flying training. So I opted for the Air Force. And, of course, as soon as I did that, they started the Korean War.
Right.
So I went through pilot training in 1950 at Randolph in San Antonio and then out at Williams in jets. Jets were pretty early in those days. They had a few T-33s, but mostly old F-80s. And upon graduation there, I went through gunnery school up at Nellis in Las Vegas and went over to the Philippines for a short time in a fighter squadron there, which was used as one of the squadrons to kind of even out the flow into Korea to fly a combat tour there in F-80s. I guess one interesting thing there in the Philippines, Frank Borman, who was the first astronaut around the moon, was a good friend of mine there, and he was also, we went over there together, and then I kind of lost track of him after that. He went into the astronaut business, but he was a good friend in those days.
Okay.
I flew a combat tour in Korea, 100 missions in the F-80, and I guess one of the things that bothers me to this day, there were four of us that flew together at Williams as one flight going through training. Two of those guys were killed in Korea, and the third one was killed in Vietnam, so I'm the sole survivor.
Wow.
After the 100 missions there, I came back to the U.S. and ended up in the Air Defense Command, where I stayed for a number of years, and I went through a series of airplanes in air defense. I started out with F-86s, the F model, then ended up 86Ds. 1957, we ended up in supersonic airplanes. They started in F-102s. I flew that for 3 years in Madison, Wisconsin, then in Newfoundland for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I went to command and staff, Air Force command and staff at Montgomery, Alabama in 1960. And leaving there, I went to fly F-106s at McCord Air Force Base up in Washington, another supersonic airplane, a very good airplane, as a matter of fact. 1962, I got a very strange message. I was working as assistant ops officer and a flight commander in that 106 squadron.
Mm-hmm.
I got a one-line message from some obscure office up in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And it wanted to know if I would volunteer for a program of great interest to the Chief of Staff, United States Air Force. One sentence. And I kind of asked around with my commander and other people. I said, what the heck is this all about? And nobody had a clue. So I said, well, if they could send me a short message like that and the chief of staff wants me for something, the only answer I could send is yes. So I sent back a one-word answer, yes.
Okay.
And that triggered off a whole series of events. I went through all kinds of astronaut physicals. It took about a week and all kinds of things. culminated in a meeting with the CIA guys. They were looking for a few pilots to start flying the A-12, which was not even really built then. It was almost done. So in 1963, I was discharged from the Air Force, hired by the CIA, told to move to Los Angeles and get ready to go to work.
Okay.
I ended up at Area 51 north of Las Vegas in the atomic energy site. The A-12 had the first flight in late 1962. When I got there, they were just beginning to get into trying to get the airplane operational. The big holdup was engines. So I got there right at the beginning of the thing. We had about eight or nine pilots that were going to fly that thing. So we ended up flying the airplane through the worked with a few Lockheed guys, but we ended up doing all the flight tests and getting the airplane operational. We lost one of our pilots on an accident during all that testing program there, another good friend. But together, we ended up getting the airplane out to pass Mach 3 and 85,000 feet or higher, and, working on all the subsystems, the cameras and everything else, get the thing operational. And a very interesting program, something that nobody else was doing, and there's only, as I mentioned, a very limited number of us. Of the pilots that were flying that airplane operationally, there's five of us left. That's it. But we got the airplane out to speed okay, but the problem was McNamara was the Secretary of Defense, and Johnson announced the airplane at some point in time there. But Mr. McNamara was dead against using it as it was designed to be used. It was designed to, overfly Russia as a follow-on to the U-2. And we could have flown over China or Russia or any place like that. But nothing happened until about 1967. I think the losses in North Vietnam, reconnaissance airplanes and stuff, were so high that they decided to deploy us to Okinawa, where they had intended us to build a facility there to use anyway. So we went over there and started flying over primarily North Vietnam on a limited basis.
What year is this?
Well, generally 1967.
Okay.
In that time period, for about a year or a little more.
Okay.
They folded the program up in 1968, another political decision. And what they did was moved the program over to the SR-71, which was a follow-on to the A-12. It came along about a year, year and a half, or two later. Same speeds. Camera systems in the beginning were not quite as good. It was a heavier airplane, could not fly quite as high, and had two people in it instead of one. But a very good airplane, nevertheless. I flew that later on out of Beale Air Force Base for a while down the road.
Sir, but, do you mind before we get into the Vietnam era, do you mind if we kind of go back and talk about your training? And
sure, let's do that.
Okay. First of all, I'm curious, do you have any memories of the Great Depression growing up?
Oh, not a whole lot, except that when I was a young kid, everybody was about the same. Nobody had much money or anything like that. But
right.
As far as the family outlook and that, my dad was regularly employed. There was food on the table, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
New clothes and new shoes and stuff like that came by relatively infrequently. When I was very young, I fooled around, trying to pick up nickels and dimes, messing around in little jobs. I ended up starting to caddy around a little nine-hole golf course. You get 25 cents for nine holes. So I'd pick up a little money there, fish golf balls out of the lake, sell them to players on Saturday and Sunday, pick up money here and there. Worked in various jobs, worked for a florist for a while, delivering flowers, things like that. I was fairly young, driving around an old florist truck. I was about 14 years old. Lucky I didn't crash it, I suppose.
Yes, sir.
But some of those things hung over into my later life. I ended up at the Naval Academy, for example. I hadn't swung a golf club in a year or two, and I didn't think I even knew how to play. But after things got quiet in the fall of the first year, a friend of mine said, "You play golf?" And I said, "Well, I used to." And we went out and played around on the course there. I had four old clubs, all, just junk. A week later comes a knock on the door, and it's the coach and the pro at the golf course, too. He's ran the golf team. He says, come on out and play a few holes. So I went out and played a few holes. He says, well, you're on the golf team, but you got to get a set of clubs. And he got the first new Tommy Armors off the production line after World War II ended. So I played on the golf team for 4 years. And, you know, just those little things in my young life, like learning how to play golf.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What did your father do for a living?
Well, he was a salesman for Armor Company, generally a meat salesman. He had an area in western Wisconsin that he traveled on, you know, once every week or two basis and hit all these grocery stores and sold them meat.
Okay.
Basically.
Okay.
Made a reasonable living, but, you know, no one was getting rich in those days.
Right. Did your mother work?
No. She was a stay-at-home mother. I had one brother and two sisters, four of us.
Okay. And what age were you to them? Were you the oldest? Or?
I was the oldest. Then okay. I had a sister, then another brother, then a brother, then another sister.
Yeah. Okay.
Boy, girl.
What are your memories of World War II?
Not a whole lot other than that, as I mentioned, when I got out of high school, all of the guys that I knew in school were gone. Everybody went off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like the thing to do, you know, everybody either enlisted or got drafted. So when I turned 17, I thought, well, I better get out of the house and head off. And I enlisted.
Okay. What's your remember, you know, you're being in high school here during the beginning of the war, I guess junior high and then high school. Do you remember what was said to you about how the war started and how the United States would win the war or get into the war?
Oh, yeah, some of that stuff, although it'd be hard to go back and remember very much of it, I suppose.
Right. Okay.
But, yes.
Was there a big patriotic drive to join?
Oh, yeah. There was, a great deal of patriotic feeling in those days. You know, it was like everybody was going to go.
Right.
Had a good friend that was a little bit older than I was. He went off with the National Guard unit when they activated them. Mm-hmm. I had an uncle that was in charge of the local National Guard company.
Okay.
And they went off to Louisiana or someplace for training. They didn't have any weapons much or anything else. They all ended up in down in New Guinea or someplace like that, or the southern Philippine Islands, you know, out in the Pacific there. And the one good friend of mine that was a little older, lived down the street a little ways, got killed and got the Medal of Honor, of all things.
Wow. Wow.
He lived about three doors from me. But my uncle, who commanded that company, eventually stayed in the South Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
He was a lieutenant colonel, and he had a real serious heart attack, and they had to retire him, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But he was down there for quite a number of years. That's my memory of World War II, roughly, just,
okay.
You know, personal things.
Okay. Was there anyone else in your family that was a member of the military besides this uncle?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I can't think of anybody offhand.
How much of an influence was he on your military career?
Oh, not a whole lot, although, you know, I knew him fairly well when I was young, but I was so young that when he went, you know, they had a little parade and the whole company went marching down the street and all that, and I think there was a lot of kind of patriotic feeling in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that he influenced many of the decisions I made.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about if you could compare that patriotic feeling you describe in the 1940s with the patriotism today after September 11th, 2001. What kind of comparison can you draw between the two?
Mm-hmm. I'd have a hard time trying to do that. I suppose, you know, I guess people are in favor of going to war with Iraq and anti-terrorism and all that. They seem to be pretty much in favor of what Bush is trying to do. I don't know. I think there was more patriotism involved back there when I was young. But the problem is I was really young then, and now
right.
I'm older.
Right.
So it's hard to kind of quantify it anyway.
Do you remember the national unity that was in the country at the time?
Oh, yeah. I think everybody was pretty much united to, you know, win the war, you know, buy war bonds, everything.
Right.
You know, they had the whole program going.
Right.
Yeah, so, it was totally different than any of the wars since, as far as I could see.
Okay. Now, in 1944, when you graduated high school, you enlisted in the Navy in 45, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, as I mentioned, I was 16 when I graduated, so I had to be 17 to enlist, so I waited till the next summer and then enlisted.
What did you do during that interim year?
Well, actually, I went down, I went to college, really.
Okay.
Eau Claire, they had in those days, Eau Claire State Teachers College was down the road about 10 miles. Mm-hmm. I took 1 year of school there.
Okay. And so you basically, were you waiting for that 17th birthday to get in, or were you
I really didn't have a plan, but, you know, after 1 year down there, I turned 17. It was either enlist or wait till I got 18 and be drafted.
Okay.
And I said, well, it's probably a good time to go.
Right. Why the Navy and not another branch of the service?
They were offering to send you right off to a technical school that I thought would probably be a good deal. I'd learn something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which maybe would help me down the road somewhere.
Right. Did that happen for you?
I was in school when the war ended.
Okay.
I was in a converted high school in Chicago. It was kind of a radio tech training school.
Okay.
And I thought they were doing a good job down there. I kind of liked it.
Mm-hmm.
The war ended, and everything went up in the air as to what was going to happen. And what really happened is within about a week or 10 days, they decided to fold the school up.
Okay.
They shipped me up to Great Lakes, and I worked there. They put me to work discharging people. You know, they had to get a bunch of people, their operators, clerks, to start discharging all these guys that were starting to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked there until as I mentioned, I took a competitive exam to try to get an appointment to a service academy.
Right.
And when that occurred, then I got out of the Navy. When I got the appointment to the Naval Academy, there was a provision in the law there somewhere that allowed you to apply for a discharge. And so I got out a little bit earlier than I might have otherwise to go to the Naval Academy.
Okay. Now, had you gone through any physical basic training at this point?
Well, I went through boot camp.
Okay.
And that's pretty physical.
Yes, sir. Where was that?
Great Lakes in Illinois.
Okay. Do you have any memories of that?
Yeah, you know, I had a whole bunch of guys there in that company, and they kept you busy full time. My memories of that are, one, I learned how to march. We did a hell of a lot of that. Two, they put you to work part time in all kinds of odd jobs, like working in dining halls, working, I can remember, you know, working back behind the kitchen, hauling meat out of the freezer, hauling, you know, carcasses around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that, you know, manual labor, really.
Mm-hmm.
But all pretty interesting in a way. You know, it was all good.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, a hell of a lot of marching and other types of training.
How did you adapt to the military lifestyle?
Reluctantly, I suppose. But, I could see the need for it. You know, in hindsight, I think all that marching and stuff is designed, of course, to teach people to obey an order as soon as they hear one.
Mm-hmm.
And it made the transition in the Naval Academy into that kind of lifestyle fairly easy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, tell me about 1946 when you go to Annapolis. How were you feeling about that experience?
Oh, well, I was kind of looking forward to it. You know, I thought, well, service academy, I'll get an education. You know, give me a chance maybe to do something down the road that I might want to do. And, you know, as my dad kind of tried to point out to me, he says, well, if you get an education from a service academy, it will be with you the rest of your life and probably help you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought, well, you know, young kid with no real prospects of doing anything, it's probably a good idea to do it.
Now, how did your parents feel about it?
I thought it was a good idea, too.
Yeah. Now, have they emphasized education to you growing up?
Oh, yes, very much so. My mother was very interested in that, you know, trying to get... The reason why I went to school early, in a way, is I went to the Catholic grade school, and the nun that taught her, my mother, in the first grade, was going to retire. And so she pressured them to take me when I was 4 years old to have the same teacher. So I ended up going a little earlier than I would have gone otherwise.
Okay. Tell me what you remember about your first year at the academy, your plebe year.
Oh, well, that's easy. The the first summer you're there, it's almost like the boot camp in the Navy. They keep you really busy. You do a lot of marching to teach you how to march, for one thing, mm-hmm. you know, so you look good on the parades and weekends and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it was involved a lot of physical activity. They had they taught you all kinds of things. For example, they had the gunnery ranges, and they taught you how to shoot rifles, pistols, and all the basic stuff that you should know. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of sailing, and they had boats around there, and they taught you how to sail. You sailed around the Chesapeake Bay in different-sized vessels of all kinds. Mm-hmm. Taught you a fair amount about seamanship and things like that. All kinds of activity that kind of took place without any of the upper class around. They're all off on training cruises and stuff in the summertime. Mm-hmm. But they had, a lot of enlisted guys as instructors doing all the, you know, the work, the teaching work and all that. So you were really busy mm-hmm. Physically, a lot of just plain old physical training, you know, a lot of running and everything else. It was a very busy summer and a lot of activity. In September, then all the upperclassmen showed up, and you got into the academic year. And it was pretty much like school mixed in with marching and a bunch of other things, athletic activity. You had to do something every they had three quarters of the year. You had to participate in the sport at some level all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you did golf?
Well, I did golf in the spring. Okay. In the fall, I messed around tried football for a while. I wasn't very good at that, and I played some intramural football. You ended up at different levels. Mm-hmm. Wintertime, I needed a sport, and they had a program which was, I thought was really good. Every sport that they had at the school would involve a couple of mandatory sessions with the coach or whoever was an expert on it to teach you, you know, the basics of everything they did there. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have some sessions where you actually got involved. For example, they had a boxing team, so everybody had to go box eventually. You know, you get out there with big gloves and wham into each other.
Right.
Wrestling, same thing. The two things that stuck with me for the rest of my life there is I got involved in handball and squash.
Okay.
And so pretty soon I ended up on the kind of an also-ran on the squash team for my winter sport.
Hmm.
But you learned kind of lifetime, if you did it right, you learned kind of lifetime sports.
Right.
I played squash and handball on and off up until just a few years ago.
Wow. And you learned it at the Naval Academy.
Yeah. I didn't even know what squash was.
Tell me what kind of student you were.
Student?
Yes, sir.
Well, in the things like engineering courses and stuff like that, I was pretty much at the, you know, pretty close to the top. Those came pretty easily. Some of the all the things, so literature, English, stuff like that, I was kind of mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
But I graduated in the upper third of the class somewhere.
Okay. What were your favorite subjects?
Well, the easy ones, of course. All the engineering courses. Heck, I could do those without even hardly thinking about them. They came easy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I had a roommate, and he struggled all the time with those. I was always working with him, you know, to try to make sure he's going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some of the other courses, I was getting by okay without too much trouble, but he was better at them than I was.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about the way it went. I was interested in flying even back then.
Were you?
Oh, yeah. When I was a young kid, I built a lot of model airplanes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I got pretty good at that. You know, hell, I had some of them fly away. That was kind of interesting, too. You want funny stories?
Yes, sir.
Okay. When I was a young kid in the early teens, if I could get $5 together, they had a little air patch at the edge of town, and there's a guy out there, one or two of them had an old yellow Piper cup. And if I could scrape $5 together, they didn't care how old you were, I could go out and take a flying lesson.
Hmm.
So I did that on two or three or four occasions and kind of learned a little bit about flying. And I was probably only 12, 13 years old, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out there one fall day, it's on the edge of town, and came out, and these two guys were sitting there kind of chit-chatting. They had an old shack there and their airplane and an outhouse. and they had their Model A Ford parked nearby there. And they were chit-chatting about something. I said, well, I'd like to get a flying lesson. They said, well, just a minute, son. Here, we got another little thing going on here, and we'll give you a flying lesson a little bit later. And about that time, there was a pumpkin patch right next door, and the guy got in the back seat of a little yellow Piper Cub and threw in three or four pumpkins, and the guy jumped in the front seat, and they took off. Mm-hmm. And I'm observing this with a lot of interest, and they come zooming around, and as they come swooping down over their little location there, they're throwing, the guy in the back seat is throwing a pumpkin out and trying to bomb the outhouse. And I said, boy, this is kind of fun. And then the pumpkin had come sailing down, splat. And about the third time they came around, the guy threw a pumpkin out, about a nice 10-pounder, and landed on right on the roof of his Model A. Mm. It went right through the roof, smashed, you know, pumpkin and everything all over it, and that was the end of the great pumpkin bombing raid. And that was my last flying lesson, too, out there.
Okay. So you had an interest in flying from a very early age.
Yeah, as I said, I built model airplanes when I was real young. I got interested in aviation. I flew, you know, took those lessons when I had a chance. And when I was at the Naval Academy, they gave you some flying training there as part of your experience. You know, you go out in the carrier in the summertime on one cruise, they put you in the back seat of some of these old torpedo bombers and stuff like that, and mm-hmm. motor off the carrier, and you could get a feel for what the flying's all about. They had some old, what they call N3Ns, old biplanes on floats at the Naval Academy. They gave you a little bit of flying training and experience there on those N3Ns.
Hmm. Tell me about your first time you were actually up in the air. How did you feel?
The first time I was what?
Actually up in the air, flying.
Oh, in the air flying?
Yes, sir. How'd you feel?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I liked it right from the start.
Okay. And at the academy, you did some flying during the summers, you said. What was your favorite experience flying?
Oh, there, I don't remember a whole lot about it as far as, you know, I thought it was interesting, mm-hmm. you know, landing, you know, getting a little bit of, you know, handling the airplane and learning a little bit about it. But they in no way tried to get you trained as a pilot or anything like that. They just were kind of exposing you to flying mm-hmm. To get people, I suppose, to kind of think about whether they want to make a decision to go into flying or not go into flying.
Right. What other memories do you have of your other 3 years at the academy?
A lot of hard work in the academic months, and then summers are busy off on, you generally went on a cruise for the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first year we went on a battleship in New Jersey, and we worked as a normal common seaman, mm-hmm. you know, chipping paint and everything else. But interesting. Second summer, I spent on the Coral Sea aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. And the third one, I was on the destroyer. You know, and the thing I remember about the destroyer, when you get in rough water, it flops around a lot.
Really?
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, they were busy, but you know, really quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The summers were okay.
Mm-hmm.
They went to Europe every summer, too.
Okay.
Took my golf clubs along. They parked the battleship near Edinburgh, by the Firth of Forth Bridge there, and as soon as I got a chance, a couple of us jumped off and went out and played golf.
Wow.
In Scotland.
That's great. Now, how much did you keep up with international events and world politics and kind of, I'm thinking of, you know, after World War II and the ramp up to the Korean War. How much were you aware of what was going on in the world?
Yeah, I'm aware of what was going on all the time, but I wasn't, big into, you know, what they were doing and why, but I was paying attention.
Mm-hmm. In 1950, were you surprised when North Korea invaded the South?
Yeah, in a way, but, you know, again, I hadn't really thought about it much, but the Korean War started, and I said, well, here we are back at war, and so off I went. I knew that I would end up over there.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I got, seems like they cranked up the Korean War right at the time I started flying training. I said, well, hell, mm-hmm. it looks like I'll get in the war right away, and I did.
Tell me about that. Well, after you graduated in 1950, where you went and what you did exactly.
From flying training?
Or after the academy in 1950.
Okay. I graduated right after I graduated. I adopted for the Air Force, before graduation.
Was that because you're flying, your love for flying, or is it because of your bad experience on the destroyer?
Yeah,
or?
I can tell you exactly why.
Okay.
At the Naval Academy, you get an assignment. They have a list of assignments for all the grads.
Uh-huh.
And you get your choice of assignments as to what is available based not on your class standing, but on a kind of a lottery, just a draw.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go into flying, and the number that I got was not very good. You know, it was pretty high up.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a look at the options. That was the first year they took 25% of the Naval Academy class into the, quote, new Air Force. So the Air Force guys in Washington came down and made a very strong pitch to go to the Air Force because they were going to get their 25% of the graduating class only if they volunteered to go there.
Okay.
If they didn't volunteer, they would not get their 25%. So I looked at the chances of getting the naval flight training with my number, and that was before the war had actually started. And I would have had to wait from 3 to 5 years to get into flight training if I had stayed in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
whereas the Air Force guys guaranteed that everybody physically qualified would go to flight training immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a decision to volunteer for the Air Force, and they got their 25% of our class, and I was one of them, and I went immediately into flight training. Went down to Randolph, started flying T-6s.
Now, you obviously knew that you were physically qualified at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, tell me about Randolph. What do you remember about that training?
Well, went down there, started flying the T-6, and all that was pretty interesting. One instructor had four students, and it keeps them pretty busy trying to get them checked out and soloed.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a little bit ahead of the power curve ahead of the other three guys, so he soloed me out right away. I had, 14 or 15 hours in the T-6, and over in some auxiliary field, he jumped out and said, go around the pattern three times and land.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he got me soloed out, where I could fly alone, then he could concentrate on the other guys. So every day I'd come down there, and I'd have a T-6 scheduled to go up and practice something. And so I would take that airplane up, even though I didn't have many flying hours. I got pretty good at doing acrobatics, loops, rolls, spins, you know, practice spins, practice
mm-hmm.
everything I wanted. So I just really had a lot of fun cranking that airplane around and learning how to do it. And the other thing that happened that was a lasting for the rest of my life is I got married.
Mm-hmm. Okay, at Randolph.
At Randolph.
Okay. Okay. How old were you then?
How old was I when I got married? Yeah, early 20s,
okay.
22 or something.
Was that the first time that you had actually flown a plane by yourself?
Yes.
How did that feel to you?
Oh, loved it.
Yeah?
Right from the start. As I mentioned, I probably had no more than 14 or 15 hours in the T-6 when he soloed it right away. He said, shoot three landings and pick them up out of this auxiliary field.
Mm-hmm.
So I made the three landings, taxied around. He jumped in the back seat and went back to Randolph. And he said, okay, you're kind of on your own here for a while. So then I'm flying all by myself regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the program, you get a check ride from one of the higher-ups in the organization there. And he said, he kind of lets you do what you want, plus he, evaluates you.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the flight, he said, have you ever thought of going into fighters? And I said, well, I kind of considered it, yeah. He says, I think you ought to. So he got me an assignment to go to Williams in F-80s.
Okay.
Finish my flying training.
Mm-hmm.
The other guys went off to, half of them went off to big airplanes, multi-engine, that sort of thing.
Tell me about your transition to a fighter plane.
Okay, went to Williams Air Force Base in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
They had brand new T-28s, which is a prop-driven airplane,
mm-hmm.
Better than the T-6. We started flying that, and it was a good little airplane, really quite acrobatic and a nice flying one. So they soloed you out on that thing quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got into things that we didn't do in the first part of the flying training. Got into formation flying, a lot more instrument flying than we got in the primary training.
Mm-hmm.
And flew that for, a month or two. And then I went to the next phase, which was they had a lot of F-80As, which are the first F-80s, and they only had a very few T-33s, the two-seaters. Mm-hmm. So I got three rides in a T-33, a jet, and then from then on I flew solo in the old F-80s practically all of the time except for instrument checks.
Okay.
So right, even in the flying training, you were doing a lot of flying in your own air machine. All by you weren't necessarily all by yourself. You're usually with a flight of four or with an instructor, you know, practicing formation, flying, and whatever,
right,
doing things like that.
Right.
But the whole thing, well, again, real interesting and kind of a lot of fun. You know, you learned a lot. You really did.
Do you remember any accidents that were happening at Randolph or Williams?
We didn't actually have any. At Randolph, they had some foreign students. There was a French guy, not in our organization, but I think he was having trouble with his love life or something like that, and he deliberately crashed a T-6 into something and killed himself.
Mm.
That's the only one I remember there. At Williams, they had a few accidents. Our class didn't have any, but I lived out in the desert area north of a place called Apache Junction, north of Mesa. My wife was out there sitting in the sun one day, and she heard the airplanes used to come kind of screaming over the house, you know, whining and screaming. She heard one that sounded a little noisier and louder than usual, and she looks out, and here comes an F-80 about a quarter of a mile from the house and goes straight into the desert with a big kawam.
Wow.
She went over there and looked around, expecting to find a wrecked airplane. And of course, there's a big hole in the ground. The biggest piece you could find was about a foot. But anyway, the guy had jumped out of the thing and had gone right into the ground right next to the house almost.
Wow.
That was not one of our guys there. We had, I don't think we had any accidents in our class. I don't remember any.
Okay. Do you remember what kind of tactics they were teaching you, fighter tactics?
Tactics?
Yes, sir.
Well, they didn't do much there other than formation flying and general basic skills as to, keeping together, working as a flight of four as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
Following that, I went up to Nellis in the gunnery training. You got more and more into that, plus all the dropping bombs, shooting guns, and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Aerial gunnery, air-to-ground gunnery, rockets, bombs, the whole works.
Why don't you go ahead and tell me about that? What was that like?
Well, I moved to Las Vegas, a small town in those days. Nellis, that's still the home of the fighter school. That's been an operational place for a long time. Main reason is they have a big hunk of airspace and ranges north of the base there where they can do things.
Mm-hmm. Was this 1951?
51.
Okay.
Summer of 51, late summer.
Okay.
And we're flying again F-80As there, A's and B's, or the old airplanes. But right from the start, you had an instructor with three other students, and he just took the three, and you flew together as a flight of four most all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And went immediately into your flying formation all the time, and you're getting pretty good at that. But you go immediately into gunnery, panel gunnery, shooting at 650 calibers and the thing, shooting at panels on the ground,
mm-hmm.
Shooting rockets at the same thing, dropping bombs, both kind of skip bomb things and dive bomb runs, learn how to, you can hit something with the darn thing, that sort of thing.
How were you at that? Were you pretty skilled, or was it?
Pretty good. I had a really good instructor, and he made it a practice to make bets on who scores the best every day on everything we were doing,
mm-hmm.
and the loser had to buy the beer after, and he'd be collecting a lot of beer. But the only thing I could, aerial gunnery, I could do pretty good, shooting at a banner, 6x30 banner, but mm-hmm. he was a real expert at it. And I could beat him at some things, and that kind of ticked him off. Mm-hmm. I can remember, for example, we used to shoot these little practice rockets, and they were liable to go any old place. They weren't very good, so I was kind of familiar with aerodynamics and all that. And when I'd go out to pre-flight the airplane, I'd look at all those rockets and the little fins on them, and usually they're kind of bent and a little crooked and all that. I'd very carefully straighten them all out,
mm-hmm.
Grab them, bend them, and try to get them as straight as I could. And every time we shot rockets, I'd beat them. And that ticked them off.
So how long did that training last, do you remember?
Oh, a few months.
Yeah.
maybe three months, something like that.
And the war's still going on, and so I assume...
Yeah, this is 1951, the war's still going on. Then we got assignments out of there in mass, really, to go to... we were all going to go to Korea, but they were using three squadrons in the Far East over there to kind of smooth the flow out and give you a little more flying. One was in the Philippines, where I went, Clark Field. There was a fighter squadron in Okinawa with F-80s, and one in Japan. And so all the guys that were flying F-80s would, at that time, went to one of those three squadrons. Mm-hmm. And then based on when the need occurred, you know, to fill the holes up in Korea, it was the 8th Wing there. Mm-hmm. I was the only one flying F-80s when I got there. And they had three squadrons there. They would funnel you in from these other bases. So I spent about 2 or 3 months in the Philippines, and the same thing down there. We did a lot of gunnery and bombing practice and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you said you flew 100 combat missions, actually.
Yeah, that was the tour over. When I got there, they'd established 100 missions as a standard tour. If you flew 100 missions, you went home. Mm-hmm. There was no and, if, or buts about it.
Right.
It was just it.
Tell me about those missions. What was a typical mission for you?
Well, when I was there, most of it was interdiction of the railroad lines and stuff like that, mm-hmm. Although that's just part of it. On an average day, we'd fly one or two missions, and it usually involved going up and punching holes in railroad lines. So we got into all kinds of things. We're punching holes in railroad lines. We started bombing some of the bridges across the Yellow River at one time. We bombed the power plants up there and caused all kinds of havoc on both sides of the river. Mm-hmm. The MiGs on the other side of the river were using commercial power, I think. We bombed the power plants that couldn't start the airplanes. But we did all of those things, plus when the ground war was getting kind of stabilized somewhere around the 38th parallel in that area. And when they had a big push going one way or another, then we do a lot of air-to-ground work with the Army guys. And we go up there with 4,000-pound bombs on the airplane and full load of 50-caliber machine gun bullets. And we'd have a forward air controller, and we'd be dropping bombs just over the trench line on the North Korean side and shooting them up. Mm-hmm. And those kind of missions actually, in some respects, were probably the most dangerous because you're down low and almost anybody could shoot at you with a rifle or whatever.
You could clearly see the troops and what you're.
You could see the trenches, yeah, and you had a forward air controller, talking to you and marking where you wanted to put the bombs and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But those were kind of interesting. We had people. We didn't lose many people over there, but we had a few shot down.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever take fire yourself?
I didn't get hit over there, but I lost of the four guys that I mentioned that I went through Williams with, two West Pointers, two Annapolis guys. Mm-hmm. In Korea, two of the guys got shot down in Korea. One good friend of mine from Annapolis, and the other guy, a West Pointer. And they're first rate guys. And both got killed in Korea. And the fourth one got shot down in Vietnam, so I'm the sole survivor.
Hmm. How did you feel flying in a war zone?
War's a war.
Well, a lot of people haven't experienced that, and they'd be curious as to know what it felt like to actually fly close air support to ground troops and things like that.
Well, you realize that, there's some danger involved, of course. And you're getting shot at, and a couple of times, I can remember one time, it was on we were bombing a bridge or something, and there were they started to get a lot of radar-controlled heavy anti-aircraft guns mm-hmm. that could lock on you, and I started out a bomb run, and these things started going off pretty close. I said, to myself, that guy's locked onto me, so I started zigging and zagging. Quite a bit because it takes a short period of time for the shell to get up there, mm-hmm. and so if I move off the track I'm on, he's probably going to miss. Mm-hmm. Well, that rascal shot at me all the way down the bottom. I thought, that's pretty good, but he didn't get me. But I don't know. You get used to it. We had one day which is I call a really bad day. We were I don't know who decided to do it, but they decided to low altitude napalm and and shoot up a supply area that the Koreans, North Koreans, had built up. And we lost, in our squadron, we lost two guys that day. That was the only day that we really had a bad, kind of a bad day. Mm-hmm. You know, but you're down there, you know, 50 or 100 feet off the ground, mm-hmm. dropping stuff. I kind of thought that was a little bit dumb. There are other interesting missions in a way. We never really bombed Pyongyang much, but early on there, I guess somebody decided that, well, we'd stop the, you know, they used the railroads quite a bit at night to haul stuff. And they had a great big roundhouse and a bunch of stuff in Pyongyang there. So one day they said, well, we'll send a bunch of airplanes up there and bomb the hell out of the roundhouse. They thought, oh, boy, we're going to Pyongyang. So we did. Went up there and, you know, I don't know how many airplanes they had, but quite a few. And bombed the hell out of the poor old roundhouse and the railroad tracks.
What other interesting missions do you recall that come to mind?
In Korea?
Yes, sir.
Not much. One other one that comes to mind, which I thought was kind of a dirty trick one, they tasked our whole squadron, 16 airplanes, to take off four napalm cans on each airplane just before dark one night, you know, late in the day. And the mission was to go to some little village of some sort, and I think what was happening is somebody had the word that the recruiters were there recruiting guys from North Korean Army or something, or something like that. I don't really know the reasoning behind it, but to this day, I kind of wonder why we did it. But we went singing in there, and it was 16 airplanes. The guys kind of first ones went through the middle. One took the one flight of four took the left side. One took the right side. I was in the last flight, and we just picked any spot that wasn't burning. We literally burned the village down, and to this day, I'm not sure exactly why, but kind of always wondered about that one.
Right, right. What contact did you have with enemy forces in the air?
Well, the MiGs were up there all the time, but
right.
If they, you'd see them up there, if they tried to jump us, we saw them coming, we could turn into them. And, you know, you trade head-on pass with them. With 650 calibers, a lot of times they didn't want to do that. So I never considered the MiGs as a real problem, although there's better, you know, better airplane than we were flying. And the whole time during my tour over there, we only had one guy get shot down by one.
Wow. So you guys did not fear those MiGs?
Not particularly.
Okay.
The F-84s, it seems to me that they had F-84s flying there, and it seemed to me they'd get hit by the MiGs more than we would. And then the F-86s were always up there, you know, tangling with them up above us. But they didn't bother us much.
Okay. What did you think of the overall American policy in the Korean War?
Well, my thinking on wars like that in Vietnam is it just ticks me off when we go into war and the policy is not to win it. It seems to me that when I was there, the policy was just not to lose it. You know, they were, yes, we had a lot of guys there and getting shot at on the ground. They went up to the Yellow River and had to come back and all that. But it seemed to me that politically it was not not being fought to win the war. It was being fought not to lose it.
Okay.
Same way in Vietnam.
Okay. What did you think of President Truman as a leader during that time?
Oh, that time period, I thought it was okay.
And what about when he fired MacArthur? How did you feel about that?
Well, I was pretty young then, and I didn't give it too much thought, I suppose, at the time. But I suppose in hindsight, it was probably justified, but I'm not sure, you know, he needed to do that. But I guess it was probably justified. I don't know. I don't have strong thoughts about it.
Okay. What kind of morale did the troops have there in Korea, the guys you flew with, and then overall what you heard?
Oh, well, I think our morale was pretty good. You know, we all knew each other pretty well. We trusted each other. We flew together, you know, and took care of each other. And went over to the bar at night, you know, had a steak or something once in a while if you could find one. No problems there.
Okay. Can you compare it to what you experienced during the Vietnam War? Was it any different?
Well, Vietnam was different in the respect that I was only flying in a limited way, very high altitude reconnaissance, you know, one guy in the airplane, same sort of, you know, spirit amongst us as a group. You know, we all worked together. together, knew each other well, we supported each other, you know, knew their families, knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
Great bunch of guys. But you, when you're flying a mission, you're all by yourself.
Okay, okay. So after your 100 missions are up, what did you do?
I took the assignment they gave me. They sent me back to the U.S. to the fighter squadron in air defense in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
This
is 1953?
Yeah, right in there.
Okay.
Well, it might have been late. It was actually late 52.
Okay.
Got there in the mall about September or so, and they had 86 Fs.
Mm-hmm.
And I checked out on that right away. It was a squadron at that time was actually a National Guard squadron that had been activated during the Korean War. Mm-hmm. So we had a mixture of old National Guard guys left over from World War II and newer, younger guys like me.
Mm-hmm.
We got along well together and all that. It was a good bunch. Started flying the 86 F, which I thought was a really a fun airplane, good airplane. And the mission was different, air defense, so we did a lot of training with radar sights on the ground and, you know, identifying unknown airplanes flying around and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, we went through one airplane after another pretty quickly. We flew 86 Fs for a while, and I could see the handwriting on the wall. We're going to get 86 Ds,
mm-hmm.
which was an interceptor version. And everybody liked the F. Nobody wanted to recognize the D was coming along. So I looked at what was required to check out in the D, and you had to have so many hours of simulator time. So I flew down to O'Hare in Chicago on my own and got the required amount of simulator time and then went back to the squadron there. They just, you know, hopped down there and back in an F-86.
Mm-hmm.
all of a sudden, excuse me, an F-86. 6D shows up, some guy ferried one in, and parked it there, and the squadron commander says, huh, anybody know anything about this? And I says, huh, I filled out the paperwork, and I said, I've had the required simulator time. He says, well, why don't you go out and fly and see what you think? So I went out and cranked it up, and off I went and flew it around. And he said, how'd you like it? And I said, well, I like the other airplane better, but it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started getting Ds. The airplanes we had, we ferried out to San Francisco, and they went over to Korea, the Fs.
Mm-hmm.
And we, as we transitioned into D, I was a flight commander and a flight instructor, so I started checking other guys out.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into that, and then, you know, a few years down the road, the F-102 showed up.
Mm-hmm.
I went out to Palmdale, California, picked up the first one, and flew it back.
What did you think of the 102?
I liked it. It was a good airplane. You know, you could get supersonic in it up to about 1.2 Mach. I flew that for about, you know, 3 or 4 years. We went to the squadron as a group went to Newfoundland in 1957 with that airplane.
Okay, from Madison?
From Madison. I flew it in Newfoundland for the 3 years I was there. Kind of liked it up there. You know, it's different. You know, it's wet and everything. And
mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, my family's growing up and getting bigger and all that. And we had, in some respects, we had a lot of fun up there.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of out in the boonies. In those days, there's a lot of things to do up there, really.
Mm-hmm.
But we flew up there in what would be considered pretty bad weather most of the time. A lot of fog, low clouds, rain, whatever. And we got pretty good at doing that, flying instruments in the rain and everything.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good squadron. Left there in 1960, went to Air Command Staff in Montgomery, Alabama, and then went to 106s up in McCord.
Okay.
And then from McCord, I went into the A-12 thing.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about comparing what you were taught with air defense and then what you did at Newfoundland and your transition to Montgomery. What rank were you at this time?
I was a captain.
A captain, okay. Did you feel like your career was progressing as you wanted it to?
Yeah, more or less. One of the problems you had was they kept, because of problems with rank and hangovers from World War II and stuff like that, that they kept bumping back the dates that you could get promoted to major and then higher grades.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at one point there, right when I was in that captain, in that category, you had to have, I think it was 14 years of service to get promoted to major because
mm-hmm.
of rank problems in mm-hmm. the structure.
And you've been in how long since 19...
Well, I graduated in flight training. I've been in the Air Force since 1950. So
right.
In 1960, 10 years, I went to command staff.
Uh-huh.
Interesting year. I had a lot of, learned a lot down there. And then I went to McCord to fly 106s, and that was a great airplane.
Right.
That thing could go past Mach 2 pretty well.
Which was your favorite airplane of the ones you did fly, besides
all of them,
the A-12?
All of those airplanes?
Yes, sir.
I put the F-86F at pretty near the top of the pile as just being a good, fun airplane, a good performing airplane that you could do acrobatics in it all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Just really nice flying airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And the 106 was a very good performing airplane, a good flight control system. I liked the 106. It was a really, it corrected a lot of things that were wrong with the 102.
Mm-hmm.
It was really quite a good airplane. It could go a long way. You could fly from, we go down to Kendall Air Force Base in Florida and for gunnery training and stuff, shoot missiles.
Mm-hmm.
You could fly that thing nonstop from McCord all the way down here.
Really?
That's quite a ways for a single-engine airplane.
Yes, it is. So what exactly were you doing at Montgomery and at McCord?
At McCord, I came in there, got checked out in the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and because of rank and experience, I was a flight commander right away
okay.
as a captain.
Okay.
I worked as a flight commander with, five or six guys in the flight. And then they made me assistant ops officer because I had a lot of experience, and they had a major there as the ops officer. So I was assistant ops officer
mm-hmm.
when I got a message in the mail one day which sent me off in another direction.
Right, right.
Okay.
Okay, sir, why don't we talk about when you received this message, did you know why you had been selected? After you found out that it was the Central Intelligence Agency, why you had been selected by them?
No, but I can speculate, based on what I know now. I think a guy sitting in his little office up there in the Pentagon was running computer checks on people looking at their backgrounds, flying time.
Mm-hmm.
I had quite a bit of flying time in fighters at that time, comparatively. I was well over 2,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in about 10 years, I was over 2,500 hours of jet time.
Wow.
And supersonic airplanes were included in there, plus a combat tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, plus your overall record in this, whatever criteria you put into the screening of records,
mm-hmm.
Spit my name out as well as some other guys. I was in a group of seven that were being evaluated to join that program. They'd already done one batch of seven prior to the one I was in,
mm-hmm.
and they'd hired four or five guys. So I was in the second bunch that they hired.
Okay. Did you have any clue at all at first that it was the Central Intelligence Agency, or?
Oh, I had no clue, but I speculated that it might be in a way. You ended up going zinging around and going on all kinds of little trips. We went down to San Antonio. We took astronaut physicals,
mm-hmm.
and everything lasted about a week. The same kind of physical the guys that went in the space program were taking.
Did they tell you? What did they tell you? Like, okay, we're going to take you down for a week and do this, but we're not going to tell you who we are?
They told you what they're going to do, but not why.
Okay.
And so you went through a series of physical exams. Then they got into some psychiatric, profiling or testing and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that, too. In fact, before they actually made a selection and told us what we were going to do, they brought the seven of us in the group I was in to a motel Marriott right by the river there by the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
and they had a consultant firm of some kind evaluating us.
Mm-hmm.
And the end of that evaluation is they selected three of us, and we went over to some obscure hotel room, and the guys with the wrong names in the room there, and they asked us if we'd want to volunteer for a program without telling us what it was.
Hmm.
And two of us volunteered.
Why didn't the third volunteer?
I don't know why, but I don't think I really want to get into that too much, but
okay.
He changed his mind later, and he was a West Pointer, and he tried to find the people that he could talk to change his mind,
mm-hmm.
and he couldn't. He had no chance of finding anybody.
Okay.
And, for the record, he actually committed suicide, and I don't want to get into that.
Okay, okay.
But anyway, two of us were selected, and then they told us what it was.
Okay. What
at
did they
that
say?
Point, and they signed a bunch of papers and said, we do it.
Did you? What did they tell you? What did they disclose to you?
They said, hey, we're developing a follow-on to U2. They showed us pictures of the airplane. It really wasn't flying yet. It was just starting to get going. You know, they had a picture of it and what it looked like. And, you know, after we said yes, and I said, whoa, that looks like a Gore. And we signed a lot of papers, and they told us what would happen then, that in the month of June of that particular year, there were 63, we just moved our family down on our own to the L.A. area, find a place to live on our own. We were technically working as a consultant to Hughes Aircraft Company with an ID card. I even went down to Hughes once in a while. They were working on the radar fire control system and stuff for the YF-12, which was to be an interceptor version. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't far off that I could go down and talk to those guys and work on that, because I had a lot of experience in that area. Mm-hmm. But that's what they did. We had an ID card and everything else. I did go down to Hughes every once in a while and chit-chat with those guys, but not seriously, really.
Were you officially retired from the Air Force? Or?
They went through the entire routine and discharged you from the Air Force.
Okay.
Just like you'd quit. The whole thing. The only thing they did was somebody in their wisdom caused them to maintain your records just as though you'd never left the Air Force. And you got flight checks and everything else in the airplane, mm-hmm. and they maintained your records as though you were still in.
Okay.
Because you had the option at the end of it, at some point in time, to go back into the Air Force or to stay out.
And you wouldn't have lost rank or anything?
They would have, the deal was, they would have, based on the records, if you were, you would get promoted along with your contemporaries as long as your record would have justified it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about a pay raise or cut? Was this?
Oh, when they signed you up, they gave you you would be paid as a, a consultant, mm-hmm. Down at Hughes. You know, a private, mm-hmm. yeah, your own employee, so to speak. So you're being paid as a consultant. It wasn't a great amount of money, but it was enough to get along. Okay. I remember it. We started out at $24,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Was it more than what you were making in the Air Force?
Yeah, but the lifestyle, because you were living on the civilian economy and all that, wasn't a great deal different.
Okay, okay.
But it was more, yeah.
I'm interested in some of the way that you were selected. What kind of questions would they ask you as far as the psychological part of it?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. You went through all kinds of things like looking at pictures and making up a story, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. They gave you... they wanted to determine your... They gave you some IQ tests, you know, stuff like that, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Just a general evaluation. It went on so long, I can't remember a lot of it, but a lot of it had to do with sitting down, they'd ask you things, and you'd write answers, and you know, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line at the end was, to try to select people out.
Right.
In the long run, they went to a lot of trouble to get guys that they could probably have saved a lot of time and effort if they'd just gone out and picked guys that had a combat tour, good operational experience, and knew what the hell they were doing flying airplanes.
Right.
They'd have done just as good.
Right.
In fact, we did that. I can tell you that we picked one guy at the end to do that when we needed one.
Uh-huh. And that worked out well?
Worked out perfectly.
And you were a part of that selection process?
Yeah. What happened was... as the program went along, and we didn't get operational right away, they were along about 1967 or so, they decided, because there were losing so many airplanes in Vietnam, that we ought to go over there and start flying reconnaissance over the north. And they moved us to Okinawa all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened is one of the guys that we had before that, one guy was a test pilot of all things, he quit. Quit the program. We had another guy quit. We had one guy they fired. We were a little bit short on pilots. And they said, well, we ought to get one. And they were going to go out with a big selection process again. And two or three of us sat around and we told them, I said, hey, knock it off. We can pick two. We'll give you two names right in the blue suit guys that were working with us, mm-hmm. right there at the area. We can pick two guys right there that are perfectly capable of doing the job. And so we took those two names, and they picked one. We checked him out, and off he went.
Okay. Did you have to sign a contract, you know, swearing secrecy?
Yeah, he signed a contract. They gave your wife all kinds of evaluations, too, all of the same thing before they even asked you to come. They wanted to make sure she was kind of stable.
Right, right. Now, was she made aware of exactly what you were doing? Or?
Absolutely not.
Okay. She didn't know you were flying A-12s and nothing?
Well, over a period of time she did, but not right away.
Okay. Was there a time limit on when you could talk about this? Or did they just tell you certain things not to talk about in general?
They never said much about it, but it was kind of understood that, you know, you kept it pretty tight. You know, if you talked to your wife and told her that, you know, this is it, just you and me, they didn't, you know, there was never any a real concern about that.
Mm-hmm. But that was basically it.
That was about it.
Okay. So where did you go after you did the, well, let me ask you about the astronaut training. Did you think for a moment that you actually would start going into the NASA program?
No, okay. Not at all.
Okay.
It's just that because of the altitudes, you're wearing a full pressure suit, the speeds and things like that, they wanted to apply the same criteria to the selection process, physically at least,
okay,
as they did to the astronauts.
Okay.
So it was easy to run you through the same physical, but I had no, it didn't seemed to me that we were ever going to end up as an astronaut. I didn't want to do that anyway.
Okay.
At that moment.
Okay. Now, can you walk me through what happened after you were selected, you signed your papers, and
sure,
you moved to Los Angeles?
Yep. We went down there. They gave us, a couple of weeks to kind of go down there, get settled, find a house in the LA area, and they said that you're probably going to commute out of Burbank, where Lockheed was. And we ended up buying a place in Pasadena because other reasons, but it was handy enough. And we did indeed fly out of Burbank. Went over there right after I got into the program, and they had a ground school run by Mr. Ben Rich, who eventually took Kelly Johnson's place as the head of the Skunk Works, and introduced us to the airplane, the construction of it, what it was like, just a regular ground school for about a week.
Okay.
Told you all about the airplane. Okay, then we were commuting to and from Area 51 from the L.A. area, and they had a couple of old Constellation airliners.
Mm-hmm.
I flew up and back every day. So you could show up at Burbank early in the morning. You'd be up there in about 45 minutes, spend as much time as you. Usually I go up there and spend about 4 days at a crack, sometimes a whole week,
mm-hmm,
and then come back. But you could go back overnight if you wanted.
Right.
But it was kind of a pain.
Right.
So I stayed up there. But after a week at ground school, learned all about the airplane, saw about all the construction, and I immediately started going up to Area 51. They had started flying the airplane before I got there, but they were having trouble getting the engines from Pratt & Whitney, so they didn't have the operational engines in the airplane yet. And they were flying they had a trainer that they were flying with different engines. And one airplane with the same engines, a single seat one,
mm-hmm,
that one of my friends jumped out of and crashed about the day I arrived.
Wow!
So we lost that airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But the engines, the J-59s that were going to power the airplane, eventually start showing up. That was kind of a delay in the program.
Mm-hmm.
So when we started getting into the real flight testing, all of us, even though some of the other guys had gotten there earlier than I did, were all about even in flying the airplane. You know, it was a quick checkout in the trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And they had F-101s there, too, which we flew as a kind of a companion airplane for support and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew the 101s around, whatever.
Okay. What was your initial impression of the A-12?
Oh, it was an amazing airplane to look at. If you look at pictures of them today, it still looks like something way far ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
It's 110 feet long, weighs about 80,000, carries 80,000 pounds of fuel, mm-hmm, weighs 140,000 pounds,
mm-hmm,
takeoff. Long, very clean-looking airplane. It was really a nice-looking airplane when you look at it. My impression was, wow. Yeah, it was a good airplane.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about Area 51, this kind of infamous secret Air Force base.
Well, while I was there, they had we had a concrete runway. It was a pretty good runway. They had an inside runway, which used in the old U-2 days. We didn't use that much, except that we had a little Cessna 210 there. Once in a while, we'd fly off there. We had a mixture of airplanes. We had the airplanes that were, the A-12s.
Mm-hmm.
We had about six or eight F-101s, 101Bs, the air defense airplanes. We had a Cessna 210, which you could putt around in, and you kind of inspect the area in the early in the morning and stuff for, people coming around or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They had a C-130. They had a T-33. What else? They had a helicopter.
Okay.
So we had a hodgepodge of airplanes there,
uh-huh.
Sort of.
How big was the base in general?
The runway was big. The early concrete runway that we had, I think, was around 12,000 feet long. While we were there, they extended it clear across the lake bed, the dry lake. It ran right into the edge of a dry lake.
Hmm.
They extended it across the lake bed while we were there, and it became about 25,000 feet.
Wow.
I mean, it was really long.
Yeah.
The base, the housing we had, they hauled in from the Navy from over around Reno somewhere, Fallon, I think. It was old World War II wooden structures,
mm-hmm.
And they had about four bedrooms in each one, and then a central area. And I kind of liked them. They were old wooden things that didn't amount to much.
Mm-hmm.
But you had your own private room there. You had a kind of a central gathering place. We used one of them. We put a bar in one of them, House 6, that became our bar,
mm-hmm.
Kind of do-it-yourself bar. Everybody
right.
Show up there.
Right.
And they had one right across, right next to where we were. They used as a dining hall for the pilots, because we would fly at odd times. They had a big dining hall, which fed everybody that worked there. They had recreational facilities that over a period of time were pretty good.
Okay.
They had they built a gym with squash courts in it, and handball courts, good gym. They had the skeet shooting range. At one time, they built a little three-hole golf course, par three. What else did they have there? The hangars and the flight line structures were all kind of left over from the U-2 days, and they were very adequate. It was a good facility, really, overall.
About how many people worked there when you were there?
I can't give you a good number. I'd guess in the probably 200-300 area
okay.
At any one time.
Okay. Now, I have to ask this. This is Area 51, so people
yep.
We're going to go, what about this lingering thought of alien space vehicles being housed there? Any word of that? Any speculation amongst your crew and what you guys?
No, none among us. And our time period, there certainly weren't any then in that time period.
Right.
But they have used it for testing a lot of secret airplanes.
Right.
Through the stealth fighters and stuff, all had mm-hmm. their originated up there,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a handy place because it's away from anything.
Right.
And they can do it in a moderate amount of secrecy.
So to your knowledge, there was no UFO?
No, I think that's a lot of foolishness.
Yeah. Now, did you get a lot of people who would try to gain access illegally to the area or kind of come too close to the fences and that surround
in
the area?
In those days, I don't think we had hardly any.
Okay.
I think as years have gone by, there have been, people climbing the mountains around there and stuff like that.
Right, right. Okay, well, tell me a little bit about your training in the A-12 and how that went.
Well, all of us, when they got there, all the guys they hired had a lot of experience.
Mm-hmm.
They all had combat tours one way or another in Korea. They all had been flying fighters of various types for quite a few hours. I think, as I mentioned, that's probably part of the selection process.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got there, actually before I got there, they sent me off to Shaw Air Force Base to get current in an F-101.
Mm-hmm.
I said, gee, I don't think that's necessary. He said, well, yeah, but this is the easy way to do it. So I went down there for a few weeks and flew it around. It was a quick transition, nothing to it. But we got up there, and they had the 101s right there, so you jump right in and start flying.
Mm-hmm.
The trainer airplane, two seats, was operational. And so practically from the first day I got there, I got checked out in that thing right away.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have engines, and it wasn't built to go out to Mach 3 or anything, but you One of the games that we used to play with, we'd go up and another thing we had to get into was some of us had never done any air refueling.
Mm-hmm.
And we had modified the 101s with a refueling receptacle, so we learned how to refuel using the F-101s. And then the trainer, our one trainer airplane, of course, we could refuel that, and then all of the other airplanes were all air refueled all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we all became almost immediate experts on air refueling. We got into that pretty heavily. But we didn't have to do a whole lot of transition, as I mentioned. We all showed up current in the 101. One or two rides in the trainer airplane, you were current in that thing. And the transition from that into the operational airplane was just jump over and go.
Mm-hmm.
So the Lockheed, one or two, maybe at times three Lockheed pilots were trying to get the airplane operational, get it out to speed, find out the problems, correct them, and get it going. A guy by the name of Bill Park did most of that, but there are other people involved too.
Mm-hmm.
And we were flying the operational airplanes as they were available right out to about the same speed that the Lockheed guys were. In fact, we were doing a lot of the test work on a lot of the subsystems in the airplane to get those things up and running while they were operating mainly on getting the airframe and the engines and that sort of thing going so they get out to speed and go properly. And one of the big problems was the inlet system.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognized early on that the way they were controlling the inlet system was not going to be adequate. It could get out to speed, but it wasn't very reliable. So they were building a new electronic control to do that. they had one airplane that had totally manually controlled inlets that was waiting for the box to show up. And I flew that one quite a bit. And heck, manually controlling the inlets, I could go right on past the speed that the Lockheed guys were going. But I had to be careful not to.
Can you describe what you mean by the inlets?
Inlet system makes the airplane go.
Okay.
The air comes into the engine, and it has to be subsonic at the face of the engine. And the inlet system is designed to transition the air from the speed you're going, like Mach 3,
mm-hmm.
three times speed of sound, down to subsonic speed going into the face of the engine so the engine can swallow the air. And the ambient pressure at 80,000 to 85,000 feet or so is pretty low, way under 1 psi. So the engine, without an inlet system to get air at higher pressure into the engine, is not going to put out any power.
Right.
So the inlet system is a supersonic, subsonic compression inlet system. They got the big spike that sticks out the front of the inlet that moves back and forth about 14 or 16 inches or something like that. And what it does is it gradually moves back as the speed increases, increases the area of the inlet, because it makes the hole bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The air comes into the inlet at above Mach 3, and it forms a shock wave right at the narrowest part of the inlet. At that shock wave, right in the narrow part of the inlet, the air then transitions to subsonic, and it goes into the face of the engine at high Mach, but subsonic speeds.
Mm-hmm.
So you hold the shock wave right in the throat of the inlet, and it converts when you're at speed up there. You've got air pressure at well under 1 psi. At the face of the engine, the inlet changes that to around 15 or 16 psi.
Okay.
So the engine's getting a lot of air and cranks out a lot of thrust. The problem is the air is real hot coming into the engine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the limiting speeds on the airplane was do not exceed 427 degrees centigrade inlet temperature. Now, 427 is hotter than a lot of engines run coming out the exhaust.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a unique system, but it worked.
What were
the fact, without that, the airplane wouldn't run.
Right, right. What besides that, what were the other major problems with the A-12 as you were checking it out?
Well, that was a major one to get it out and keep it at speed, and that made going to an electronic inlet made the airplane.
Okay.
That made the performance go.
Okay.
All the rest of the problems were minor. There were problems with different systems on the engine itself. They had things around the engine, inlets, bypass doors, things like that, to control the airflow properly. And that they were addressed pretty early on by the engineers and the Lockheed guys, and they corrected those as they came on them. But that was early on. the operational pilots, a lot of the work we did were all the subsystems. We worked on the autopilots, the radios, all of the other systems in the airplane that needed to be checked out and in many cases improved. Had inertial navigation system, for example. All those things, the operational pilots, we were flying out the same speed as the Lockheed guys, but we were primarily interested in making the airplane an operational system that you could use rather than working on just the actual functioning to make the airplane operate properly at speed.
Mm-hmm.
So they worked on the engineering part of getting it out to speed and safely staying there. We worked on all the subsystems to keep it, make it an operational machine.
Okay. Were there any problems as far as any accidents that happened with the A-12 in the training?
Not really. They had problems with tires and things like that. You know, the tires were exposed to very low air pressure. At takeoff, you're going, when you got a full fuel load, you're going faster at takeoff than most airplanes are cruising. You know,
mm-hmm.
If you had a full fuel load, you didn't get airborne until about 250 knots. That's
wow.
Pretty fast.
Wow.
And so we had tire problems and things like that that had to be worked on. We had one guy blew out a bunch of tires on takeoff, and he landed. He lost his hydraulic system. He ran off the runway. It didn't hurt the airplane particularly.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any real accidents in there, except we lost one pilot in the course of the operational training, I guess you'd call it.
Okay.
And without getting into the real details, he had to bail out short of the airfield, and he was killed due to a problem with the parachute.
Okay. How long did your training last there?
Well, it lasted the whole time we're there. You're always our training.
Okay.
But as far as being operational and ready to go, I would say within a year or so, we could have gone operational and used the airplane. But the political will in Washington with Lyndon Johnson and particularly McNamara was not there to use the airplane. We were tasked early on when they shot down a U-2 over Cuba
mm-hmm.
To go over there. And right away we started running missions that went down to southern Florida, kind of simulated going over Cuba
mm-hmm.
without actually doing it. But we could have done that at any time.
Did you ever go over Cuba?
No.
Okay. Did McNamara ever come personally to Area 51 and check
Never.
It out?
Mr. Dick Helms, who ran the CIA, was out there regularly.
Okay. What did you think of Dick Helms?
Great guy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was probably as good a guy running the CIA as they're going to get. He's dead now, but I had great respect for him.
Okay.
He was very practical. He knew what he was doing. He was an old spy, I guess, from the old days in World War II, but very high regard for him.
Okay. Would he personally meet with you, the pilots?
Yes. And that's another interesting thing about that program. Kelly Johnson, who I think the world of, too, he would come down there every Friday early on and just have one of the engineers with him and meet with just the pilots, nobody else.
Wow.
And talk about the airplane, what was good, what was bad about it. So you could really open up and, get into a lot of detail with him. And what you liked, what you didn't like. And those meetings early on, resulted in a number of changes to the airplane, some of the subsystems in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like oxygen system, radios, a bunch of things.
Right.
We got him to change. And that's kind of hard to do. But he paid attention, and he listened, and when he thought it was worthwhile, he made the changes.
Oh, that's great. I'm sure you guys were very happy with that, having that direct contact.
Yeah. I give him a lot of credit for that. He really, in the early days, to get the airplane operational going, he spent a lot of his time just talking to the air crews and then working with his engineers, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the world of that guy, too. He's also dead.
How many people actually were on a crew that would work on one of the airplanes?
Can't answer that exactly, but our maintenance crew is probably no more than around 1 to 200 people total that worked on the airplane.
Okay.
Compared to, say, the SR-71, the follow-on over at Beale, they had the blue suit guys used a lot more people.
Okay.
These were all dedicated. They were all civilian employees with Blue Suit Air Force supervision.
Okay.
We had a colonel out there running the maintenance, stuff like that.
Okay.
But the maintenance guys were all contract.
Hmm. Interesting. Were they from? Were they flown in also from Los Angeles, or were they?
Yeah, they all flew in and out of Los Angeles. Some of them lived in Las Vegas and had an airplane going to from there too.
Okay. Did you ever get to take any side trips to Las Vegas?
I moved there finally.
Did you really?
After 3 years, I told these guys, I said, there's too smoggy around L.A., I want to move.
Okay.
They didn't want any of the air crews to live in Los Angeles, in Las Vegas, although all the other guys were.
Now why is that?
Well, I don't know. They just thought it would, compromise the program in some way, but it really didn't. So I talked them into it, and I sold my house and moved to Las Vegas for the last couple of years.
Okay. Now, you were there from 63 all the way until...
68 when they folded the program.
Okay. Now, did you know going into it, as you were going through the testing of the A-12, that you were going to be tasked eventually to Vietnam, or was that something you found out later?
No, we knew initially that the purpose of the airplane is overfly the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And China.
Okay.
And we knew that right from the start.
Okay.
As I said, the political will wasn't there to do that, and the Vietnam thing came along. Yes, we could do that very easily, but there was never any desire to do that, I guess, up in Washington until I think Dick Helms was the one that did that.
Mm-hmm.
McNamara had no, he would not use the airplanes there. Dick Helms talked to Lyndon Johnson privately one day, I think. The State Department didn't want us to do it either. Dick Helms... talked to Lyndon Johnson and told him about this airplane. He didn't even know about it, what it really could do.
Really?
Yeah, he knew about it, but he didn't know what it could do.
Uh-huh.
And they were losing a lot of reconnaissance planes about that time over North Vietnam. And he says, hey, let us go over there. We can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. So all of a sudden, we were tasked to do it. But it would not have happened without Dick Helms.
Why do you think McNamara and DOD didn't want you to do this?
Well, it was the State Department didn't want to do it because they wanted to close the airplane down. McNamara didn't like having the CIA in the flying business.
Why not?
I don't know. I think the State Department kind of got to him because the State Department. Had all the problems with Gary Powers getting shot down
right.
over Russia and all that, and
right.
they had visions of the same thing.
Okay.
And all that did was make a lot of trouble for the State Department.
Right.
So the two of them together wanted to get the CIA out of the flying business.
That's interesting. It would seem that they could deal with a possible political fallout versus a huge strategic and even tactical advantage.
Yes. But, I don't know how those guys think, but they were not in favor of using the airplane
mm-hmm.
as it was designed to be used.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what did you think of the power shootdown, that incident?
Oh, well, I don't have a whole lot of comment about it particularly. It was unfortunate. I think the CIA wanted him to commit suicide, but I agree with him.
He chose not to.
But, he was okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you guys given those tablets? Or
no, nothing like that.
Okay. Did you have
that's another subject, though. We were given an awful lot of survival training and evasion, stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At great length, really.
That was going to be my next question. What did they tell you about that kind of scenario? Did they train you in what to do and what to say and things like
that? Yeah, we actually went through training, one time we were actually spent about a week in, I think it was in a Washington area, I don't even know exactly where it was, but it was an authentic Vietnam prison camp.
Wow.
With the cells and everything.
Uh-huh.
I can tell you where it was, but they didn't want us to do that.
Where was it?
Well, I'm not going to say where it was.
Okay.
But I know where it was,
okay.
But they didn't. They went to great pains not to have us know that, but I know anyway.
Okay.
But it was like a prison camp, and they treated us just like we were in a Vietnam prison for a while.
Hmm.
And you had the option, if you really got tired of it, you could say, I quit. One guy did.
Oh, really?
he's one of the guys that quit the program, too.
And he was out of the program, was he?
Well, he didn't. He wasn't out then, but he was eventually.
Okay.
They give you a lot of training like that. They did give us a lot of survival training. They had experienced Air Force instructors with you. We went down and trained in the swamps of Florida. We trained up in the mountains. And the survival training went on endlessly. We did. We used to do parasail training out in Lake Mead in the full pressure suits. You know, like you're going to make a water landing. You come down in a parachute.
Mm-hmm.
They unhook you, and you're coming down in a parachute and plop in the water in a full pressure suit and have to get into life raft and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of survival training. It was amazing how much they gave us.
What kind of weapons training did they give you?
Nothing.
Did you carry
any weapons? One of the things they said is, you know, if you actually went down over Russia or something like that, they said that, like, if you actually flew over Russia, they got you to say, you know, here's my name and I work for the CIA.
Really?
Yeah, just tell them flat out.
Uh-huh. And yeah. So you had no sidearm with you?
No, I never carried any sidearms.
Did you want one?
No, not particularly. It would not have been handy to carry wearing a full pressure suit anyway.
Right. Okay.
Carried none of that stuff.
What else did they tell you about being shot down, say, over China or over North Vietnam, besides the survival training? Did they tell you what to say, what not to say?
Well, the survival training was pretty much, along the lines, try to tell them whatever they asked for except certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And they even had training into I don't even remember all the details now, but you had some kind of an individual code. Or if you had a chance, you could say some things, and if they could find out what you said back in Washington, they would know how come you were there. You know,
okay.
Whether you got shot down or had an aircraft problem or something.
Right.
Because they wanted to know those things.
Right.
So they that training went on almost full time all the time.
Hmm. What did they tell you not to talk about?
Not a whole lot. You could tell them you worked for the CIA. Anything having to do with what you were doing, photography and stuff like that. I really don't know anything about what I'm doing. You know, I was just told to operate this airplane, you know, and when I get to a certain point, I turn on switch A, and when I get to another place, I turn off switch B, and that's all I know. They didn't want to know anything about the quality of the photography or anything like that.
Did you guys know about the quality of the photography?
They didn't want us to know, but we all did.
How did you find that out?
Well, I'd go in the training flights, for example, like one day early in the program there, I flew a mission that went about out to the Mississippi River and back about an hour, and came over Liberal, Kansas, which has a triangular airfield easy to identify. And it was in the fall of the year, so I just out of curiosity, I went over at the Ranfield. I went over to the guys that were processing it, and I said, let's see what we got. So they put it on the light table, and I looked down at it. That was the only time I ever did that. And, I'm up there about 80,000, a little higher. And the school band was practicing in the fall for the football game.
Mm-hmm.
I could identify every instrument in the band.
Wow.
That sort of thing. They didn't want you to really know how good the photography was because then you'd be prone to tell them.
Right.
But that's about the only time I did that. The rest of the time, I'm familiar with it, but I didn't go look at it.
So what's the statement that has come out in, over time that the U-2 and then the A-12 could actually read a newspaper from 80,000 feet? Was that accurate?
Well, I don't know. You could probably read it. I would say, I don't know how it is these days. They continue to improve the products as the years went by on all of those airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the 1960s.
Right.
It was probably good enough to maybe read the name of the newspaper or something like that. I don't know whether you could read. I don't think you could read the fine print.
Okay. So tell me, you get your orders to go to Vietnam.
Sure.
Or to actually, you go over to, you're based out of Okinawa, is that correct?
Yeah, Kadena.
Okay.
They built a facility over there to, to handle the airplane. That was in the program for quite some time.
Okay. Tell me about your transfer overseas.
Well, we flew three planes over, and the guys that flew the airplanes over were the first three that arrived on the scene to start with. They didn't know how to sort them out, so they said, well, we'll just take them by seniority in the program.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys are there a month or two longer than me flew them over.
How old were you at this time, sir?
1960s, born 1927,
So you were
30s, 40s.
You were 40 years old, basically.
Yeah, getting close to it, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so anyway, the three of you go over.
Three guys flew the airplanes over.
And
how
long did that take?
Oh, they took in the neighborhood of the refuelings and all that, and going the long way around 5 hours or a little more, 5.5 hours.
Okay.
Nonstop.
Right.
I flew the last one out coming the other way.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay. So once you arrived over in Okinawa, where were you set up, and what was your base like there?
Okay, you're on the base at Kadena. They set up housekeeping in an old World War II area that had Quonset huts over in the far side of the base that was not being used. They took a look at that rather than be on the main part of the base, and it was sort of isolated enough that it was kind of nice in a way.
Mm-hmm.
These World War II Quonsets were not fancy, but they served purposes quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived there. We had our own little Quonset. There was a couple of with enough bedrooms, and we had a big open area there with our dining area. They had a mess hall there, but we used our own little dining area most of the time with a full time cook.
Okay. Did they keep you guys isolated from the other personnel on the base?
No, not at all.
Okay.
We just didn't talk about what we were doing and even let them know who we were.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, we were just there.
Were you in civilian clothes?
Yes.
Okay.
Full time.
And the A-12s, where were they housed?
They built the CIA had built a hangar facility there over, in anticipation to flying them out of there quite some years before.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a hangar facility that we used, and then when the SR-71s came in later and replaced us, they took over the whole thing.
Okay.
Same facility, just moved right in. Moved one airplane out, moved the other in.
Now, I assume that you landed at nighttime when you arrived, and would you take off?
Not necessarily. I didn't fly them over, but they wouldn't necessarily arrive at night or anything.
How did you keep the A-12, this brand-new airplane, kind of secret from the rest of the people on the base? Because they could see it take off and land.
We didn't.
Oh, so they knew about it.
Oh, yeah. You taxi out, and heck, all these Okinawans and stuff there, they had the little farming patches right around the edge of the field. And hell, they'd line up at the fence and everything, watching them go.
Okay. So what was your typical mission like, your typical surveillance mission?
Okay, down in North Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
You'd take off. We would normally refuel, go up to 30,000 feet or so, refuel after takeoff because it was easier on the airplane to take off with a light fuel load. You took off with a full fuel load, the bouncing around, and the thing was like a big wet balloon and bouncing up and down with hard on the airframe.
Okay.
So we'd take off with a light fuel load. And in fact, the SRs went to that, too, when they became operational. They did the same thing. But we'd take off with a light fuel load, hit a tanker, 30,000 feet, gas it up. You would go down supersonic. You'd be going 3.1 Mach, 3.15, about 85,000 feet, somewhere in there. And a typical mission would be you'd stay over the water between Hong Kong and the Philippines going down there.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go around one kind of typical one. You'd have to circle around Hainan Island. That was
mm-hmm.
kind of right in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of bend around to the right around it and make a left turn
mm-hmm.
and go right over North Vietnam, maybe about over Hanoi or somewhere. They'd vary the route a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Pass over there going around 85,000 feet, a little higher. 3.15, 3.2 Mach.
Mm-hmm.
Cameras on, take pictures. You'd make a left turn. And, in fact, if you made a left turn while you're there, you could look about 75 miles into China
mm-hmm.
in the photography.
Mm-hmm.
Make a left turn and start a descent down towards Bangkok. And you get down down in Thailand down there, you'd hit a tanker down there at 30,000 feet again.
Mm-hmm.
Refuel it, gas it up, turn around. Accelerate out going north about the same way. You'd get up to speed up past Mach 3 just about the time you had to make a right turn out over North Vietnam again.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd come back across North Vietnam with a little different route, but fairly heavy on fuel, and you would be up to speed up to 3.15, 3.2 Mach, but not quite as high. You'd be over 80,000 feet, but not as high as you'd like to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd pass on out of there. Go around Hainan Island again and putt back to Okinawa. It'd take about 3 hours, a little bit.
About a three-hour round trip?
Yeah, a little over.
Okay. Did you like operating by yourself in that airplane?
Yeah, I really did. I like to fly alone. I essentially flew alone all of my life.
Right.
If you're all alone in the airplane, you don't have to worry about the other guy.
That's true. Very true. You felt, I guess, more in control
I was very comfortable all by myself. That never bothered me at all.
Okay. Now, how did you control the cameras, or were they remote controlled, or?
You control them, but it was mostly just switches.
Okay.
Switches on, off, that sort of thing.
So you were told, you know, at what point?
You had a flight plan, and you were following the flight plan, and you got to a certain point, you know, flick on switch A, switch B, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just turn on the switches.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually take pictures of China as well when you were close by?
Well, as I say, it was a byproduct, but if you made a right turn over North Vietnam where the camera is looking off to the right,
mm-hmm.
you know, the airplane is in the bank,
mm-hmm.
The photography would go across
mm-hmm.
the river into China.
Right.
You know, there was no effort to fly over China.
Okay.
That was just a byproduct.
Okay. What did you understand about why the United States was in Vietnam at this point when you had gotten there? The war had certainly progressed to a point. This is 1967, correct?
Yeah, it was. I don't know. We went in there. I know this is primarily about Vietnam, but you know, as far as I know, we went into Vietnam to prevent the North Vietnamese, the communists, from taking over the whole place.
Okay.
And so they went in there to do that. And I'm not a great fan of going to war with limited objectives like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go into all kinds of wars and we never finish them.
Mm-hmm.
I was over in Korea. You know, we quit the stalemate right about where they started.
Mm-hmm.
We never finished that war. Okay. Vietnam, we never finished that one. I think if you're going to go to war, you ought to finish the damn things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make an effort. You know, either go in and do it right or don't do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like Clinton sent people to Bosnia. They're going to be there 1 year. Hell, they're going to be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
Korean War, we still got, I don't know, 40, 50,000 troops sitting over there since then.
Mm-hmm.
We got people all over the world. It's amazing. The people still in Japan from World War II. There are people in Germany and all kinds of places,
mm-hmm.
hangovers from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the wars we finished, but we haven't finished many since World War II.
Right. What would you advocate the United States to do differently? Say, for example, in Vietnam, what would you have liked to have seen done differently?
If you're gonna go to war, you ought to have the objective of winning the damn war and getting it over with.
Okay.
And this business of you know, kind of getting into stalemate sort of thing. I mentioned I lost two of them, the guys I went through flying training with, our little flight of four, Williams, in Korea.
Yes, sir.
And they're just going back and forth, flighting over around the 38th parallel at that time. Vietnam, I lost the third guy. He got shot down over North Vietnam. I had a lot of good friends lost in Vietnam, and it kind of ticks me off, not so much that they were lost, but they were lost in a war that was not meant to be won.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say it was not meant to be won?
McNamara up there was running the war from the Pentagon, and the typical example that I think of back in those days is it was something somebody wrote somewhere. It says, well, he'd select the targets for the next day's bombing, and it was similar to saying, we're going to bomb these wooden bridges on some road in West Virginia, and then we'd call Washington and say, you had enough yet?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't. There was not an effort to win the war until Reagan came in, decided to end it by sending B-52s and stuff over North Vietnam.
You mean Nixon?
Was it Nixon?
Richard,
yeah.
Nixon in the early,
yeah,
70s.
You're right.
Okay.
My brain doesn't always operate properly.
tell me about, well, first of all, you said the morale of your guys were pretty high the whole time. You had a good camaraderie.
Oh, yeah, we had a very small group of pilots. The maintenance guys were, I consider, as good as you'll ever find.
Mm-hmm.
The blue suiters that were operating, you know, in the group there, were a very small organization, very close-knit, very efficient way to run an organization, really.
Really?
Like ours. Well, compared to, say, the SR-71, we were doing with a few hundred people what they're doing with in the thousands or more, you know, 1,000 guys or more.
Why did they change it?
Blue suit operation, you know, that just the structure that the Air Force has. You know, they have a big wing, and they have a wing staff, and they have a squadron, and they have a lot more maintenance guys, blue suiters, and they rotate a lot in and out of their jobs. So the training is always part of the program. They have a lot more guys involved in training, and they tried to keep them there longer,
mm-hmm.
but the system doesn't allow that very much. Whereas we had guys that were dedicated to that one airplane, and could do a lot of different jobs and do it very efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So you operated with a smaller number of guys that knew just about everything there was to know.
Right.
And they would never rotate out of the job much. They were permanent.
Hmm. What was the overall feeling at the time? The same question I asked you, what did you think of what was going on in Vietnam and why the United States is there? What did your comrades think? What did your fellow pilots think, and then the maintenance crew? Did you guys
we didn't talk about it too much, but I think the general opinion was about the same. You know, if we're going to fight the war, let's do it and get it over with.
So you thought that at the time that there was a limited objective. You could tell this.
Absolutely.
Okay. Despite the fact that Washington was trying to say otherwise publicly that we were out to...
It was obvious that Mr. McNamara and he's kind of controlling things as near as I could tell.
Mm-hmm.
And the State Department probably too, maybe to some extent, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Objectives were very limited.
Okay. Did you ever get visited by one of these higher-ups?
No.
Okay.
I never had anybody ever say that.
Okay. I was just wondering if they even paid you a visit over there to kind of inspect what you guys were doing.
No, as I mentioned, Mr. Helms came out to the area a few times, but when we were in Okinawa, nobody showed up over there much.
Okay. How long were you there total in Okinawa?
Oh, maybe a year or a little more, and they decided all of a sudden to retire us and put the SR-71s in there out of Beale. Problem with that was they weren't quite ready yet, and so there was some turmoil for a while after they came in and started operating until they really got going, but they worked out okay in the long run.
Okay. Tell me what would happen to your photographs after you got back. What would happen to the airplane?
The photography came out, and then at the time we were there, they put on another airplane, as I remember it, and they went straight to Hawaii to a processing squadron there that would process it and then farm them out to the guys that would use them. And they actually went to the Army guys that were using them in many cases just to plan the next day's ground activity.
Okay.
And the other stuff, they were looking at... you know, they get all the intel out of North Vietnam, where the SAM sites were, and, as much as they could about what's going on up there, and I think that went straight to Washington.
So it's a pretty quick turnaround.
Quick turnaround.
Okay.
The information would be in the processing place in the same day you got it, and the next day the information would be available.
Hmm. Okay. Tell me about the air defenses in North Vietnam.
Well, a lot of SAMs, as far as we were concerned, we weren't concerned about any low-altitude stuff, but the SAMs were a problem. And we did have some defensive systems on the airplane that worked properly. We never had an airplane shot down or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one that ever got hit, I guess. I went in the last mission I actually flew down there. I went in over North Vietnam. I was the only guy there. It was about noon. Usually the weather was bad, so we didn't go down there very often, but in October, I guess it was October of 67, we had 3 days of absolutely clear weather, and there were two of us over there. I went down the first and the third day. A guy named Frank Murray went down the middle day,
mm-hmm.
And I got a lot of activity going in and out. You got lights and things that tell you when you're being tracked and stuff.
How did they know you were there?
They could pick us up on radar. We had a very low radar to return, but we found out early on, and we thought that the cross-section of the airplane was such that they would not be able to track us very well on radar.
Mm-hmm.
But we found out the Chinese and the Vietnam guys, they had radar that could, in the right hands, they could track us.
Okay. Did you ever run into any other aircraft up that high?
No, but flying around the States, once in a while, there'd be a balloon up there.
Oh, really?
A research balloon or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
No airplanes.
Okay. Well, anyway, go ahead about the SAMs.
Okay. On those 3 days, I went down there on the first and third day, late October of 67. And the first day, in and out, I got a lot of lights and tracking information. I didn't see any SAMs coming up. The third day, a guy in between had a lot of the same activity. The third day, I said, well, I think there's not much going on down there around noon. I said, I think those buggers are going to try to shoot at me here sooner or later. So as I was coming in, I had a lot of activity, tracking information, and I don't know whether they shot or not. I wasn't looking around much. I was busy.
Can you explain quickly, I'm sorry, what you mean by you had a lot of activity, a lot of lights going on?
Lights, okay. You had the lights that when you were being picked up by radar, the SAM radar,
mm-hmm.
It would tell you. You had another light that would tell you if they were locked onto you.
Okay.
And they're launching the SAM and tracking you.
Okay.
And you had another light that told you when they were sending guidance signals to the SAM. They were they transmit their guidance signal to the SAM from the ground.
Right.
And it steers it from the ground.
Okay. What kind of countermeasures did you have?
We had one in those days. The only real one we had on our airplane was one that sent a hard over flipper signal to the SAM when it got close enough to you. I didn't like that very well because if it got close enough to you, they send a hard over flipper signal on the same frequency that had to overpower the ground signal.
Right.
And it could only do that when it was very close to the airplane.
That's scary.
Yeah. So anyway, they tracked me going in on the third day. I refueled, and I said, I know those buggers are going to shoot at me coming out because I'll be heavy on fuel and not as high.
Mm-hmm.
So coming out, you just about get up to speed as you make a right-hand turn over to go into North Vietnam and back out to the east. So I left the throttles right up to the wall to get as much altitude as I could, and I'm going about 3.25 Mach, and I got all the indications again, and I made one mistake there. We got a little tiny periscope you could put up at the top of the cockpit, and it's a little prism thing, and you can see behind you.
Mm-hmm.
So I put that up, and as I went zinging out, I got all these launch signals and stuff, and I said, I started looking around a bit, and one SAM went off the right wing, maybe 100 yards or so.
Could you tell how many had been launched against you?
I couldn't tell. But I saw this one going straight up, and it was kind of spinning, and so I assumed that the ECM gave it a hard over flipper, and it missed me. But otherwise, I think it might have gotten me.
Okay.
So it went zinging by going up. And I think there were three or four more that did the same thing that I didn't see, because I started looking in the rearview periscope. Well, what happens is the SAM goes up, and we trigger the hard over signal, flipper signal on that ECM equipment. It misses you going up. Then it gets out of the signal, and it starts to guide again. And it goes up to about 90,000 feet or a little higher, and it turns over and starts coming down and tries to chase you up your tail.
Hmm.
So it's still chasing you. Well, they have a time of flight on them where they self-destruct or something. I've forgotten what it is, but it's about 1 minute or something like that. And so these, I'm looking in the rear view, my little rear view periscope, and I could see these explosions going off behind me, boom, 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 like a flak gunner in Korea, except there were SAMs. But they could not quite catch me. They were guiding again, but they were trying to catch me coming up the rear, and they couldn't quite do it.
Okay.
But I did picked up a little piece of metal off the nose fuse of one of them it got out in front of me, and I just ran over it at a very low velocity. It barely punched a hole in the skin of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It's about as big as your fingernail. So I'm the only guy that ever got hit.
Did you hear it happen, or?
Oh no, I didn't know it happened.
Okay, but you saw it.
They found a little tiny hole in the airplane when it got down. That's the only way they knew it.
Okay, now was that the first and only time you've been shot at? Actually, seen the SAMs fly by your aircraft, or?
That was the only time I actually saw any. You got to recognize we didn't fly many missions down there. Mm-hmm. I think the whole year I was there, I only flew about four missions. Would have been about seven or eight passes over North Vietnam.
Okay,
so you didn't fly very often.
Okay,
the big problem was the weather.
Right.
You know, we're flying high altitude. You know, it's cloudy down there most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Last mission I flew before they retired us, they launched me on one not too long before they sent us home.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that the weather looks pretty marginal. We don't know. And I got down about the Philippines, and I got a radio call, and they turned me around and sent me back.
Hmm. Okay.
The satellite, they didn't have many satellites in those days, but when the satellite came around, they had the satellite picture, and they said immediately, no chance of any photography, and they just turned me around.
So that was your very last mission?
That was the last one I flew there, yeah.
Okay. And the last mission over Vietnam is when you were shot at?
Yeah, the last one I actually went over Vietnam, I got shot at that time, yeah.
Okay.
Flew some after that, but it wasn't me. We rotated to and from the States, you know, different guys were over there.
Okay. Where else would you fly your missions over? Out of Okinawa?
Well, that's the only place we went except... I was not over there when it occurred, but they took the Pueblo, and there was great confusion in Washington when they did that. That was unexpected, and we had the boss that we had over there was kind of practical, and he told the guys, he says, dream up a mission right away to go over North Korea. We had not been flying over North Korea. Mm-hmm. And he sent a message off to Washington, something to the effect that unless you do not concur, we intend to fly an airplane over North Korea tomorrow morning and see what's going on.
Uh-huh.
And I think that stirred him up there, and I think they approved it, and we cranked up an airplane early the next morning. A guy named Frank Murray flew that one, and he made a couple of two, three passes over North Vietnam, a nice clear day, and right down in Wonsan Harbor, there's the old Pueblo sitting there, mm-hmm. bigger than heck. So it gave the guys in Washington a little, you know, early on information of where the boat was. And
mm-hmm.
you could see, you know, people and stuff. You can't identify them, but you can see people on the ground and stuff like that with the mm-hmm. photography. But at least the guys in Washington knew what happened to the boat and where it was and, you
right.
know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But that, and then that triggered off then. We didn't fly over North Korea anymore, but the SR-71s that replaced it shortly thereafter ran some regular flights periodically over North Vietnam after that,
okay.
doing the same thing.
Okay. Did you ever fly one of the SR-71s?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
I when I left the program, I went back into the Air Force. I went to the Air Defense Command here in Colorado Springs. I was running all their, I was a lieutenant colonel then, running all their test programs and stuff, which primarily were done down at Tyndall in Florida,
mm-hmm.
All their weapon systems. And this, I got pretty heavily involved in that. And all of a sudden, they promoted me to colonel and sent me off to the National War College in Washington. And when I left there, they sent me, because I had all that flying experience, they sent me to Beale as a director of operations of the 9th Wing out there, which had the SR-71s. And I was a vice commander due to take over the wing when I got grounded due to going deaf in the right ear. I was grounded for a number of years.
Hmm.
So that caused me a lot of heartburn and problems. But I was out there and rotated through the commander's job out there at Kadena, a place in which I was very familiar with, of course, because we moved right into the same buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So I operated for a two-year period as one of the commanders of the operating location over there, and during that time we were actually doing a few flights over North Korea and Vietnam at the same time.
Okay.
But I wasn't, I got current in the SR-71. They usually didn't have the wing staff guys fly the airplane because the flying time is expensive and you're not going to fly operational missions.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got there, the guy that was a wing commander said, "You want to check out?" And I said, "Yeah, let me check out because it will provide some the air crews will know that I'm familiar with the airplane and what they're doing."
Right.
And so I took one ride in the trainer airplane that they had there, and then they said, "Well, I'll fly one flight in the A model, you know, the regular operational airplane,
mm-hmm.
and at least they'll know that I, you know, can fly it."
Mm-hmm.
So I flew one flight in the A model and got current in it, and then you know, went back to my job as wing DO and vice commander.
How did the SR-71 compare to the A-12?
I liked the airplane okay, but I always liked the A-12 better because it was 5,000 pounds lighter. I was all by myself. I thought it was flew a little bit better, not much. It would fly 5,000 pounds lighter is 5,000 feet higher.
Right, okay. Okay. So it was safer, actually.
Yeah, in a way, and at the time we had better cameras too, because the cameras, when they would put the second seat in the SR, that's where our big camera was,
mm-hmm.
and they then had to put the cameras out in the chine areas on the sides of the airplane and put in mirrors and folded lenses and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
and it took them quite a number of years to get the quality of the photography up to where we were when they folded up the other program.
Okay.
Other than that, the airplane was a fine airplane.
Okay. How did you find yourself as a leader? Did you enjoy that position, or did it come naturally to you?
I didn't mind it. I never considered myself as being a leader, except that when I was put in those positions, I
mm-hmm.
operated as one. You know, I thought I was a fairly good commander, yeah.
Okay. So when you left Okinawa, you went back and you entered...
When I was in Okinawa over there with the SR-71, I was operating as a commander of the operating location there with all the maintenance guys and everybody there under me.
Right.
They had a SAC wing there that I had to argue with a colonel over there all the time because he wanted to take over our business. They had tankers and stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I fairly effectively kept ourselves kind of isolated from his influence.
Right.
Best I could.
So you actually got you were put back into uniform.
I was back in uniform as a colonel in the Air Force then.
Right, right, when you came back. Mm-hmm. What years were you commander up there at Kadena?
I went to Beale in 1971. I think I left there in 73. I got grounded. I went deaf in one ear. I was going to be the wing commander.
Mm-hmm.
And I got grounded because I went deaf in one ear and had a lot of vertigo, and I was grounded for a number of years.
What happened with that? How'd you get
Never determined. Huh. Undetermined.
Did it come back?
No, I'm deaf in one ear, and I still have my eye movements are abnormal. In fact, I eventually got myself back in flying status by spending quite a bit of time with the doctor guys down in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, I was the only guy in the entire Air Force that went back to flying status with a totally bad ear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I flew out my career doing a bunch of other things, but it bumped me out of the SR-71 business
mm-hmm.
at an inopportune time, I might put it.
Right. How did you feel when you came back to the United States in 1968 about the war effort in Vietnam?
Same as I said before, we're not trying to win the war.
Okay. What was your opinion of the anti-war movement that was festering in the country?
Oh, I didn't think that was very helpful and all that. I can understand why they're doing it, but I didn't. I was not sympathetic to them at all. I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I understood why they didn't want to go over there. They started out as guys that didn't want to get drafted and get over there and shot at and that sort of thing, I can understand that, but nevertheless, I'm more in favor of supporting the country, even though I may think it's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm curious as to how you felt about when the war was ending, and you're actually over in Okinawa when the United States pulls out,
uh-huh.
and the Paris Peace Conference has ended.
I'm gone from it then.
Yeah, everything's done.
Mm-hmm. I'm gone.
Okay. How did you feel about the United States in 1973 when it had pulled out of South Vietnam and kind of Vietnamized the war and turned it over to the South Vietnamese to fight for themselves?
Well, I can't give you a good opinion on that, except that the general feeling was that we're kind of abandoning them, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
I had kind of that feeling that there was not, I was not very comfortable with that.
Did you feel like the United States had achieved peace with honor, as was said in Paris?
No, I don't think so. We never tried. We got them to the table and got, to quit the war, but I never thought that the way we went about pursuing the war was, I was never very happy with that. I'm a great believer, if you're going to go to war, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go full out and get the damn thing over with. Mm-hmm. I mentioned, Bosnia and Yugoslavia and all those places. You can think of all kinds of wars ever since. Seems to be the only war we ever faced was World War II.
Right, right. Did you ever have any desire to actually go into Vietnam itself on foot and see the country for yourself, or South Vietnam and see the country?
Yeah, I think I would have liked to do that, but I never really had an opportunity to. I was in and out of Saigon a couple of times over the SR business, but... it was such a brief trip. It wasn't even worthwhile. I got no feeling at all for the country or anything like that.
So you really had no opinion of the country itself.
No, I have no feeling for the guys on the ground and all of that stuff. I had friends that were flying out of Thailand and other places, but as far as the actual feel for South Vietnam and the country, I really didn't have any. I never spent any time down there really.
Right. I'm curious as to how you dealt with actually flying in a combat zone. And I know you did it in Korea, 100 missions.
Sure.
And then you're doing it over North Vietnam a few times.
That didn't bother me much. I signed up in the military to do that. And I think through the years I've always figured that that goes with the program.
Mm-hmm.
If they want me to fly over... Korea or fly over Vietnam or fly over Moscow, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the United States should have ever been involved in Vietnam, or should we have left it to the Vietnamese to deal with them?
Well, of course, there's a lot of hindsight in there, but
I
kind of think we probably shouldn't have gotten involved, but once we did, we should have pursued it full out.
Mm-hmm. think the United States government learned any lessons from the Vietnam War?
I'd have to say not much.
Okay.
Maybe with Bush up there and those guys, you know, he's talking about Gulf War and all that. Maybe, you know, I'm ambivalent about what he's trying to do there. I think maybe it needs to be done. But my feeling was I was really ticked when the elder Bush could have driven the tanks right up into Baghdad and the palace doorstep in just 24 hours, and he didn't do it. You know, didn't finish that one. And then they allowed to, you know, they ended up with the dang guys burning every oil well in Kuwait down, and while we did nothing except put the fire out.
Do you think that the United States government knows how to deal with such a conflict as Vietnam, kind of a limited war? Is that a war that's possible to fight, or something that we can understand now?
I think they probably know pretty much about how to do that and what should be done. I give the guys a lot of credit that are up there in the Pentagon or whoever doing the planning. I would think they could do that. I think the problem is the political will and the political side of it is whether they want to do it or not. I don't think there's any problem of how to do it and what to do. It's just the political will of whether they want to do it.
Do you think that the civilian leadership and the political and the military leadership should be separated? And do you think that there should be civilian control over the military?
Sure. You know, the civilians. I think the civilians should run the country, and the military should do what they want them to do. I would just question their judgment in many cases. That's all. But I don't think the military ought to run the country. No.
Okay. Okay. What did you think of the media coverage of the Vietnam War?
Good question, and I don't really have a good answer. You know, going back quite a while, I don't think the media was really getting the overall picture out of what's really going on down there. That's
okay.
My impression.
Okay.
That's all. I don't have anything to base it on.
What about today, the media coverage of warfare today? And there's the information that one can receive is almost overwhelming if you listen to the radio.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there.
the print media, everything. What do you think?
That's okay. I think in some cases we're still not getting the whole picture, but in some cases you're getting so much that I don't know whether it's worthwhile to get it or not. And I don't know whether it's helpful. You know, you're never quite sure how accurate it all is and whatever. But you do get a lot of it in a big hurry.
Yes, that's for sure. Have you read books on the Vietnam War?
No, not a whole lot. I've read some books, yeah.
I'm
trying to think of a few. There was one there about the three Naval Academy guys I remember reading. It's John McCain and Poindexter and Ollie North, something like that. I forgot the name of that one.
Nightingale Song, right.
I thought that was a fairly well-written book, and Ollie North over in Vietnam and stuff, it kind of gave you a good picture of what some of the activity was over there. But I've read a few other books, but I don't recall them at the moment.
Okay. What about movies about the Vietnam War? Have you seen these?
I haven't seen many at all. I haven't really looked at any.
Is it just basically a lack of interest, or are you avoiding it?
Well, to some degree, I guess that's true, because I'm not, I kind of hate to go back and think about things like that in some respects.
Okay. This is a question that I enjoy asking as far as the culture of the time. What do you remember of the 1960s, and in particular, when you hear songs on the radio today or wherever you would hear them, does it take you back to that time, does it take you back to the Vietnam War time?
Yeah, I suppose I do occasionally, yeah.
Does anything come to mind?
Nothing particular, except the guys that, you know, were good friends that are gone.
Have you been to the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
What was your experience there?
Very moving. There's a number of names on there. I look for and found them.
What kind of effect did it have upon you?
Well, it's amazing how many people were there, for one thing. That's a good memorial because it has all those names out there. I don't think I want to talk about it.
Okay. We'll move on. Today, sir, if if you had to talk to young people about the Vietnam War,
sure,
what would you tell them?
Well, I think it was a war that I don't know whether it should have been fought, but it was not fought in the manner to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we're going to go to war, that we ought to do it right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you think that kids today should get the information about how the United States conducted itself in Southeast Asia?
I think the project that you're doing is probably right at the top of the list.
Appreciate that.
You know, to really get the different views and different word out from different people that kind of really get into what happened over there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to give a kind of a brief rundown of what you did after you left Kadena in 73 and where your career went? Because you spent a long time in the military.
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened. When I got grounded, I went off to Chanute Air Force Base as a Vice Commander of Tech Training Center and stayed there a while.
Mm-hmm.
Finally got myself back in flying status, and that then sent me to Mather Air Force Base as a Wing Commander to train navigators, of all things.
Hmm.
I was there a year. They moved me down to Randolph Air Force Base in Texas, where I was at DCS Ops running all the flying training for the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
All the pilot and navigator training, and that was a good job for me.
Yeah,
I was into that stuff. I was there 2 years, and I should have gone off to the Pentagon, but for various reasons I didn't. I went to an air division that it was in SAC at Abilene, Texas.
Okay.
Dyess Air Force Base. And I spent a few years there. That was kind of a dead-end job in a way, partially my own fault. And
When did you make general?
I made general when I was a colonel when I went into the DCS ops job down at Air Training Command. They immediately promoted me to general officer.
Okay.
Running the flying training.
Okay.
And, you know, in hindsight, I should have, from there, the next career move, I should have gone to the Pentagon, but I had some reasons why I didn't do that.
Okay.
But I ended up coming back to Colorado Springs, where I owned the house that I bought in 1968 and only lived in for a year. I rented the thing out, and we came back here for the last year. I operated as a commander. They wanted a general officer in Cheyenne Mountain,
mm-hmm.
In that facility.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first one that they put out there, and I knew that it was within 1 year of retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the job primarily to move here to Colorado Springs, and that was an interesting job, but,
yeah.
You know, it's not one that I would like full-time or anything like that.
Tell me about Cheyenne Mountain. What was that like?
Well, it's an interesting facility. They mm-hmm. built, you know, back in the 50s, they blew a big hole in the mountain and built big caverns in there and put three-story buildings in there on the springs and stuff so that, you know, a nuclear explosion, they have to take two or three pretty big ones to knock the thing down.
Mm-hmm.
Had great big doors going in and all that. When you're inside there, it's just as though you're in any other building without windows. They have a lot of nice pictures around to make you think you're outside or something.
Uh-huh.
I found it interesting to work up there. Nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the work they were doing, I think, was quite necessary. There are a lot of things that were happening. You know, we get all the satellite information coming in from different types of satellites out there. And one thing that, you know, every once in a while we get a call from somebody, the satellite thing, hey, we got a hot spot in a certain spot, and we take a look at it, and it's not moving. We just call somebody, like it's up in Canada or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
They'd say, oh, we'll go out and look, and then pretty soon we get a call back, yeah, we got a forest fire out there, but it's in the boonies, we can't get to it. Things like that.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing what the satellites would pick up. You know, they even in going back a long ways, they would, if you had fighters in Russia that light up their afterburner or fire off a missile or something, the infrared could pick up those launches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure it's gotten a lot better since then, but I'm sure the satellites do give them an awful lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
But I was into that back before I retired, but that's a long time ago.
What year were you there at Cheyenne?
I retired in 1983, was it?
Yep.
Yeah, 82 to 83.
Okay.
March 83.
Yep, and then I retired.
Okay. What would you say over your career was the most tense time for you as a military officer?
Oh, well, I don't remember any really tense times. The worst times probably were when I got grounded and had to move and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're out in 82, 83, and
yep.
You did a total of what, 30?
30, well, I ended up, if you count the Naval Academy, about 38 years of military service.
Wow.
The 4 years of the Naval Academy, you're actually midshipman in the U.S. Navy, so mm-hmm. It's actually, it's a really sort of an active duty thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as how the Central Intelligence Agency has treated you since you left the CIA and went back into the regular Air Force.
Haven't had any contact with them other than they took some pictures of me standing by the airplane back early on when we were up at the area there, and they lost them somewhere.
Okay.
And I talked to the protocol gal one day, and she said, well, they gave us all a CIA and intelligence star when we quit.
Mm-hmm.
I called up there and said, hey, I don't have any of those pictures. And the protocol gal says, well, let me look around. She found them down the archive somewhere.
Really?
Yeah. That's the only time I've talked to him.
Okay. Okay. Well, sir, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation today?
No, except it's been interesting talking to you, and I don't know whether this is helpful to you, but...
Absolutely, sir.
Yeah, thanks for including me.
Well, sure, it's our pleasure, and we appreciate your time.
Okay.
And we'll sign off now. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.